The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada and is supported by the generous donations of our listeners. If you would like to partner with us in this ministry, please go to apologeticscanada.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
All right. Andy is particularly chipper today.
I'm fired up and ready to go.
All right.
We're ready.
All right, Terry, what you got for us today?
Well, you sent me an article that
Well, we'll talk about this.
Even find this on your own, Terry.
No.
You should be ashamed.
It was from you.
No, it wasn't from me. It was from Steve.
Oh, was it from me? I don't know.
Okay. Well, let me find out.
Okay. Pilotless planes are coming.
Oh, yeah, that's that was me.
But no one wants to be on them. Okay.
I do, Terry.
What's your first thought about that? Like, just off the cuff.
I wouldn't want to be on the airplane. Although, you know, from what I understand, most airplanes, they just run on their own.
Right. I was actually all right with it. Because I figure you're already 30,000 feet in the air in a tin can. I mean, what worse, you know, what more could, you know, worse could go on? Like, I would say, yeah, I'd do it.
So there was a survey of 8,000 people. Half of them said they wouldn't go on a pilotless plane, even if there was a discount.
See, on if there the was a discount, prices. I would even be.
I'd jump on it right now, man.
Well, my thing is, like, you're on pilotless, you know, subways all the time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, or whatever else it might be that's guiding itself. Well, I mean, and honestly, we even had, you know, we had Mike Hiscock in here the other day, and he's a pilot and said pretty much 90% of the flight is it's driving itself.
Well, there's automated landings. Like, they have that.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole time they're in the air, it's all automated.
Yeah.
Right? They're not doing anything. They're
sitting,
landing the plane and taking off the plane.
Sipping an espresso.
Oh, yeah.
I know what they're doing.
But I think one of the biggest problems that I was thinking about, like, you know, if these are run by computers and there's nobody there inside the cockpit, what's the chances of it being hacked?
That was my biggest concern. Two things. If it got hacked or, you know, something goes wrong with the computer or whatever, which Lord knows will probably happen.
Yeah.
If it's anything like my computer.
Well, they talk about having pilots on the ground still looking over the plane after the plane, right?
That doesn't comfort me.
No. Wow.
Just the other day, I was watching this video of this emergency landing where this pilot was like his landing gear basically got locked. So the wheels were turned 90 degrees the other way.
Right.
Yeah. So as he was landing, he kept the nose of the airplane up for as long as he could.
Yeah.
And he just burnt right through the rubber as he landed.
See, that's one of those problems, right? When a computer's flying things, can it account for that, you know?
Yeah.
Added to the fact that the computer doesn't feel the pressure of 200 lives in their hands.
Right.
Which I'd like it to at some level.
So yeah, moving on. Just a little while ago, somebody, a listener, brought this to our attention, and this has been talked about in the news.
Maybe we should just pause there for a moment. Thank you, listeners, for when you send these things our direction. We don't know everything that's going on the internet, mm-hmm. and these little treasure troves are appreciated. Keep sending them.
Yeah. So this listener sent in this interview, this quick interview that was done by James Franco.
James Franco, yep.
James Franco, an actor. In this interview, James Franco is interviewing a philosopher from Princeton, a very prestigious school.
Yeah, not just a philosopher from Princeton, a professor.
Basically, what James Franco was talking about was the issue of abortion. And it is actually quite comical because this philosophy professor starts making her argument. And you can just see
it's comical until you realize this is a philosophy professor at Princeton, and then your soul starts to weep inside.
Yeah, yeah. Because you know, like you can start to see like her argument just seems really circular, and you can see it on James Franco's face. Like he's just like, really? That's the argument that you're giving me.
It's an incredibly dehumanizing argument.
Yeah. So basically what she said was this. Her argument is that not all early fetuses are equal, basically. Some have moral status, others don't. And what determines that is basically whether it will have a future or not. And what she means by that is, let's just pretend that I'm a woman and I'm pregnant, right? If I keep this child and this child is born and, you know, gains self-awareness and is born and grows up to have a future like that, then it was wrong for me to kill the early fetus because it had a moral status then. But if I just have an abortion when I have an early fetus, then by the virtue of the fact that this fetus wasn't going to have a future,
well, it was won't okay. have a future because right. you aborted the child.
Right. So then this early fetus didn't have any moral status, so it was not wrong to kill.
Let me quote it in her own words. She says this: "You had moral status, but if your mother had chosen to abort you, then it wouldn't have been the case that you would have been or would have moral status."
Mm-hmm. So it's all based on a decision of basically, yes, well, I'm going to keep it, or no,
actually,
I'm not.
Actually, yeah, but actually she addresses it. Like, this listener actually also sent us her journal article, and she addresses that question. Like, it doesn't this mean that it's basically the woman's choice? That's what decides. And she says, no, it's whether the fetus has its actual future. That's what determines the moral status, not the mother's decision.
But that's ridiculous, because it's the mother's decision that's going to decide whether or not it has a future. Because I think this is an important point. First of all, we just got to clear the air here. We're using her words, fetus, which I despise, mm-hmm. is a child. This is a baby in the womb that in fact does have a future. Mm-hmm. They all have a future, but in fact that future is being taken from them by the mother's choice to kill the child.
Her view, though, is that these early fetuses or early children, to use our words, mm-hmm. they don't actually have a moral status to begin with, right? It's the fact of whether they will have a future. So it kind of works like retroactively, which doesn't really make any sense to me.
Right. But here's one of the things I think is a foundation to what she's working from. And that is that human beings do not come into the world with inherent value. That value is something that develops from what she said as consciousness, you know, awareness, that requires that child to have a future. So in that future, those things are being actualized. And once that gets actualized, then moral status is endowed to this child.
Right. She calls it the actual future principle.
So, I mean, when the baby is still in the womb and that mother makes the decision for the future of that child, does it become a human then? You know what I mean? Like, they determined it has a future now because she said yes.
It's like Schrodinger's cat with regards to humanity, which if you've ever heard that, it's a thought experiment with quantum mechanics. But, you know, whether the cat is going to die or the cat's not going to die. But now you got a baby. Is it going to be a human or is it not going to be a human?
Right. Because of quantum superposition or whatever, the cat is both alive and dead at the same time until you open the box to observe.
Yeah, because Peter Singer, by the way, would say, I've heard him say, you know, he's kind of all over the place on this, that it's not until 2 years of age that personhood is
endowed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, that is, see, I see this sort of human versus person distinction all the time, but isn't it precisely this distinction that we have historically used to dehumanize somebody else, right?
Oh, and that when you hear her giving her argument, it's exactly what it is. It's dehumanizing. Mm-hmm. It's dehumanizing this child. And really what it's doing is saying that value is found in consciousness from what she said. Mm-hmm. Now, this gets interesting because even Singer would argue that then and what happens in old life when you, let's say, dementia begins to rob you of your memories?
Following his logic, then these people should be disposable.
Oh, yeah, or if you're in a coma or whatever it might be. You don't have consciousness. You can't feel pain at this
point. When it comes to coma, though, as I understand what this professor and what Singer would say is that, well, this person can come out of a coma, right? So what they'll say is,
but don't you think that's arbitrary? Because you, the same argument, by the way, is given for going to sleep, right? When you go to sleep, you lose consciousness at some level. But doesn't that seem arbitrary? Like, how do they get to decide that because you're going to come back from it, you know, although they don't know this in the same way she doesn't know the future of the child, right? It's all in hindsight, right?
She would say that, I mean, it's pretty reliable with our given like medical technology and things like that. We can, given the high probability that if the woman chooses to keep her child, then we know with reasonable certainty that this child is going to have a future. And that's the way that she would answer the question.
Well, that gets interesting though, right? Because that would apply then to a person sleeping. We have a high probability that they're going to wake up from sleeping.
Yeah, so basically what ends up happening here, as I've read and studied this issue, is this. What they say is that this is a consciousness is a threshold kind of a property, right? It gets kind of, if you will, triggered at some point early in your life.
Or developed.
And then you're going to have it. Yeah, sure, you're going to sleep and lose, for example, self-consciousness for a time, but then you get it back and things like that. Now, I love Francis Beckwith and the way he handles these sorts of things. Like, yeah, this man is just intense. And one of the things he points out is that if we are to say that, for example, if you fall asleep and you come back, you lost self-consciousness, self-awareness, and you gained it back. Now, if we're to argue that you are the same person, which I think is reasonable to assume, right? You're the same person that you were after you woke up than you were before you went to sleep, then what you're saying is that there is some underlying personal unity which experiences this sort of self-awareness and then loses it for a time while you're asleep and gains it. It doesn't make any sense to say that you were a person and then you weren't a person anymore while you're sleeping and then you were a person. But it makes perfect sense to say you're the same person who just had consciousness, who lost it for a time and then gained it back. Mm-hmm. And so there's the personal unity.
With her view that this child really does not have any inherent value, that the value is inferred to the child in its potential future of whether or not it gains consciousness.
Well, actual future, she would say, right? It's the actual future that gives the moral status.
Right, right. Yeah, because then she would say, like she says to Franco and the guy that's with him, I can't remember his name, that they have value because they have a future.
Right. It's like, it's all hindsight. You can't...
Right. But you wouldn't know whether or not that child has a future or not, according to her view.
Well, that's where she says we have reasonable certainty because of the advancement in medical technology and things like that. And so if a mother chooses to abort the child, we have reasonable certainty that the child is going to die. And see, here's the problem, right? Just like you said, Terry, earlier, in effect, it comes down to whether the woman wants the child or not. That's what
or
in the
wants
end,
that child to have a future or not.
In effect, determines the child's value. Now, what this professor will say is that no, it's not the woman's choice. It's the actual future that the child is going to have that determines the moral status. But I mean, what difference does it make? I mean, if I'm playing billiard,
it's all retroactive at that point,
right? If I'm playing billiard, right, and I strike the cue ball and the cue ball sinks the eight ball, right? Who sunk it? I did, right? Whether I used a stick, whether I used the cue ball to sink the eight ball or not, at the end of the day, it's me that started the chain of reaction, right? So sure, you can say that it's the actual future that confers that moral status, but it's really the woman by the virtue of her choice that confers or takes away that moral status.
This is my point then. If it's retroactive, it means that the child had no value in the beginning.
She would agree with that, yeah.
And to start with your point, I think this is where in Christianity, this is such an important point to our understanding of human value, that it begins with God, that that value is inferred to you mm-hmm. by no human being. It was given to you by God, and that it was given to you at conception, and that you were made in the image of God. Mm-hmm. It means then that the your view of God is going to directly dictate your view of humanity if you're made in the image of God. So the greater your view of God, the greater your view of humanity. And I see this being the problem of secular humanism. They have no view of God. And so what you have then is a system, at least, that has to develop without God. A system that tries to be coherent within itself. And as you see with her view, it's completely circular reasoning. They're groping to try to find some way to show that life has value. But you just can't do it. There's that ground is just becomes sand as she begins to try to make this argument. But think about this one. What about this person that has a child, or let's just go with the fetus mm-hmm. in their womb, and uses some technology to find out if it's male or female, prefers a male child, and so because it's a female child, decides that it doesn't want this child to have a future. I think it's fascinating to me that people would be morally outraged by that mm-hmm. and have a problem with this woman's philosophy because now you've made the choice because not that you made a choice, but how you made that choice.
Right.
Now all of a sudden matters.
It matters, yeah. See, that's one of the things that I find very intriguing about some of these philosophies is that their values start colliding with each other.
What I find interesting about the article is that her like redefining morality in a sense, right? Like she is choosing what is moral and what is not. I mean, that's just our culture today, and that's what you're saying as well. Is that not just very problematic that there is not a ground and anybody can choose what morality can be or cannot be?
It's a big problem.
Huge problem.
Can I just say too what concerns me about this problem? One of the things that I just find deeply troubling about this video, and I think that listeners should be troubled by, especially for us at Apologetics Canada, as we've gone to different universities and interacted with these professors, it's come to my attention that this is what's being taught at the highest level, you know, in these Ivy League schools to our potential leaders in the world are being taught these ideas. And as I work with young adults, one of the things that I'm continually reminded by, and if there's young adults listening to this, I just want you to hear me out here. If you're in college, I don't care if it's a secular college or a Christian college, you need somebody in your life that you can bounce off the ideas you're hearing and get a second right. opinion. It's kind of like going to the doctor and getting some, you know, prognosis. You know, you don't just take the first person's perspective. You go and you get a second opinion. And I think that is incredibly valuable, especially in the secular university. I had a young adult actually come and have coffee with me just last week. Their professor was saying all sorts of things and wanted to get a second opinion on that history and whether or not there was another way of viewing that. And I find this continually. They found that incredibly helpful. It's easy for a student to be taught by somebody like this mm-hmm. and to think if that view hasn't been challenged, to just yeah. think, oh, this is a great way to view the world.
Unfortunately, in our secular universities, there tends to be this. I mean, I guess it's the same wherever you go. But one thing you need to watch out for is this groupthink, right? That everybody thinks this way, and so I should think this way too. And mm-hmm. one of the things that I found really helpful going to, for example, I went to Biola University. It's a Christian private university down in California. One of the things that I found really helpful is that, sure, we had sort of our leanings, but it was always in contrast to the ideas that were coming out of secular universities. And so we got to sort of learn the ideas that are coming out of the secular university, and we're now pitting that against the Christian. So we had a chance to sort of interact with both ideas.
Get out of the bubble.
Right. But I'm not sure, like from what I hear from a lot of the students who go to secular universities, it's like, you know, this is the only...
Oh, that never happens.
What do you think about this whole redefining coming into the Christian realms as well? because there's not a ground in our scriptures about who we are in Christ and, you know, the image of God, the scriptures are not our go-to in practice.
In practice, yeah.
So, I mean, if we don't have that ground with the scriptures, we seem to redefine what Jesus is, what morality is, all these topics. I came through to an article by Willie Parker, or about a guy named Willie Parker, and he's a Christian. I don't know if you heard about this guy.
He's an abortion doctor, isn't he?
He is an abortion doctor, says he's a Christian. His book is called Life Works, A Moral Argument for Choice. So he's kind of arguing the same thing, that it is morally okay for the woman to...
In fact, he would say it is his duty to serve the women that are under his care.
Yeah.
Right, and that is a Christian duty. Right, that would be his argument.
This guy's a Christian that's arguing for abortion.
Yeah,
yeah,
and he's done thousands and thousands. I was reading the article, and I could hardly stomach what he was saying within his book.
Well, let me help you out there. He's not a Christian doing abortions. I can tell you that right now.
But he says he is.
Yeah, I know. He might say he is a Christian, but there is no way.
At least a
Christian could participate in the killing of children.
At least I would say he is a Christian who is just so terribly misinformed. That's how I would look at it. Because I mean, when I talk to my
approach, it's a possibility.
Yeah, it's a possibility. Like I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt here.
Yeah, you're being nicer than I am.
Yeah. But when I talk to my pro-choice friends, I always try to remember, okay, they are coming from a position. I mean, there could be any number of reasons why my friends are holding this view, right? For all I know, they had abortions done like themselves. That I don't know. So there might be emotional reasons and things like that. But what I always try to do is, okay, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and just think they hold to certain conclusions because they hold certain assumptions to begin with, right? And it is those assumptions that I'm going to go after. Let's talk about this, right? And so then after we hash that out, if my friend is still holding on to those conclusions, for example, that it is morally permissible to kill unborn children, then I would ask, okay, what's your reason? Because I just gave you reasons to think otherwise, but you're still holding on to your conclusion. So what that tells me is that you still are looking for a way to justify your position. Well, if you come up with a reason, if you come up with a good philosophical reason, argumentation for it, let me know. But as long as my refutation of your arguments is sound, you should change your position, right? So that's how I go about it typically, but... Yeah.
But anything he was saying, like, he doesn't believe God's personal, right? So that's a big...
See, already there's a...
Already there's a problem.
I already told you, man. Like, this guy. Dude, that sounds like Buddhism or Islam.
With a Christian veneer.
Yeah, with a Christian veneer. Let me go back, though, because this is there's an underlying assumption, though, to this woman's argument that I think we've just got to quickly talk about here that has to be exposed. And it's simply this. Who says, because it seems very arbitrary to me, I mean, who says that even given her argument and the future potential of this child gaining consciousness, who says that that is the line of what dictates what a person is, consciousness or sentience? You know, that's just granting her a whole lot, by the way, and saying that this child isn't conscious or doesn't feel pain.
Right. So this becomes a bit of a problem because typically the reason that some of these philosophers hold to the idea that it's sentience, right? It's consciousness, these sorts of things, that's what's important because it is often argued the child cannot, or the fetus, as they call it, cannot be harmed if the child is not conscious of it. Which doesn't make any sense because they're confusing the experience of harm with harm itself,
mm-hmm. right? I mean, this goes back to sleep or unconsciousness or whatever else it might be. For example, if you rape somebody that's unconscious, mm-hmm. well, I guess now you would have to argue, well, they'll eventually be conscious and become aware of it, and then it becomes bad. Mm-hmm. But until they become aware of it, it's not bad.
Or what if, for example, hypothetically speaking, right, I use date rape drugs or something like that, do something horrible to a woman, but then I somehow cover it up in such a way that she'll never know what happened to her. Am I off the hook?
Yeah, was it morally
wrong?
Obviously
not, right?
Right. Yeah, and I've said this before, but I've got to say it again. This is what gets me concerned in our culture that is – I think it's important for people to appreciate. Notice how our culture is defining what a person is. Mm-hmm. They are defining a person by sentience and consciousness. And I think what is going to happen when we have robots or machines that can mimic those two things? Man, is that going to cause a lot of trouble.
Actually, Frank Beckwith also had something to say about that, this sort of functional view of a person.
Yeah, call it a performance.
Right.
You perform as a human.
So basically what he would say is, let's say there's this basketball player who is playing basketball, so he's a basketball player, but then in the middle of the game, he comes over to, like, after he scores a goal or whatever, he runs over to his wife and gives her a kiss and then comes back to play basketball. Now, was he not a basketball player when he went off court to give his wife a kiss, a celebratory kiss? Well, obviously not. Like, I mean, sure, he ceased to perform or function as a basketball player when he went off court to give his wife a kiss. But he is a basketball player, right? Because, well, he is. And so just because you cease to perform in a certain way doesn't mean you cease to be what you are. Mm-hmm. It's basically his argument. And I found it very persuasive. Huh.
This becomes, though, problematic where you have machines that now be able to perform in these certain ways.
Right. If that's your view of what a person is.
Now what do we do with these machines? Right. And notice that this is never about a machine becoming a person. All of these things are dehumanizing. It in fact becomes a person, a human being that starts to be viewed as a machine. Mm-hmm. And I think more and more that's what we're seeing. And back to your analogy, we now as human beings are being viewed as performances. We are biological performances of consciousness, biological right. performances of love or whatever else it might be.
Philosopher, ethicist James Rachels, the late James Rachels, who, by the way, wrote the textbook that we used to study ethics or whatever. But anyway, his view of personhood and things like that was it's the narrative of the person. Right, it's the total sum of the person's experiences. That's what gives the person value. And so he uses the example of a Texan bull rider who gets into a car accident, horribly burned. For him, life was all about, his narrative was all about womanizing and riding bulls and all that kind of stuff. Now he can't do that anymore. Rachels would argue that it is now permissible to end his life because he has determined that his life can no longer support his narrative. And
or this is like pretty that. Much the plot line of the movie Me Before You.
Right. And so then the problem is, well, if you go with that view, there are some metaphysical absurdities, right? Because if you are total sum of your experiences or something of that sort, then with each experience that you gain, you're literally a different person from moment to moment. So then this, you see something very similar in Buddhism and their view of human beings, which, you know, according to which you are just a fluctuation of five different aggregates, right? And so you're literally a different person from moment to moment. So what happens then is, again, metaphysical absurdity. If I commit a murder, the next moment I'm a different person. I am no longer responsible for what I did because I didn't do it, because I, whatever you mean by that, was a different person just a moment ago. See, this is a problem, as I see it, is in a world without God, you try to ground human value in
something. This is what I was saying.
Like, where do you go?
That's the problem. Where you go is the best that you can do is yourself. And you become God, the arbiter of what is going to be the, you know, human value. And so for this professor, this is what she's decided is going to be you know, the grounds of human value.
Yeah, this is the
and that was my point, by the way, of who gets to say. Right. Who gets to say that consciousness or sentience or the future potential is what gives you value? Well, and without God, you get a say. So that's her view, great for her, but now I'll just come up with my own view of human value.
Which at the end becomes all relativistic, which actually leads to moral nihilism.
Yes.
Because it's just might makes right. You know, it's basically Carl Panzram all over again. By the way, for our listeners, if you don't know who Carl Panzram is, you should look him up. He's a fascinating figure.
A terrible person.
Very terrible person. there is actually a documentary about him on Netflix, so you might find that very interesting.
What's it called?
That I couldn't tell you. I'm sure if you just type his name, it'll show up. But but he's a, if nothing else, just look him up, Carl Panzram, P-A-N-Z-R-A-M, on Google, and you'll find...
Z if you're American?
Yes. this is apologetics.
Little translation
Canada
work
Indian.
There.
and he lived his nihilistic philosophy, and he lived out...
How many people did he kill?
He probably murdered, according to his claim, which can be exaggerated... over 20 people he murdered, and then over 1,000 people that he sodomized, you know, young and old.
Truly terrible. But had sound reasoning according to his philosophy.
Yeah, it's the only difference is the veneer of it, right?
Yep.
You have a Princeton philosopher like whose ideas are a bit more respected because, well, she is a philosopher who works at a very prestigious institution. Whereas, you know, here is Carl Panzram, who's a scum of the earth. But their ideas are ultimately in line with each other.
Yeah, I guess I shouldn't say it's sound reasoning, but it is their reasoning, right? They've put together their philosophy.
You know, when you become the arbiter of human value via your philosophy or whatever, then... who can't take away your value, right? You just got to hope that you are not one of the weak ones.
And I think that if anything, this should be of serious concern to an aging population of baby boomers.
Right.
You know, we talked about this on our last show with regards to how we treat the elderly. And I think that this is going to continually become a problem, especially with doctor-assisted death, where we see people that are devaluing themselves in a society that I think will continue to devalue people, not just in the womb, but those exiting life as well. Mm-hmm. And particularly if society views them as a burden. Yeah. And this is, I think, another important point that people need to appreciate. And that is often people in our culture will say, oh, well, what's good for you, you know, that's fine, as long as it doesn't affect me. Right. And here's the problem. People don't understand that sin affects everyone. Sin is not isolated to an individual. We are a society of people, and others' sins will affect you. Mm-hmm. I think it's fascinating, given China's one-child policy and the number of females that have been aborted in preference to boys, which, by the way, has been on average 119 boys born to every 100 girls, that now we have a gendercide like the world's never ever seen. But a complete imbalance of men versus women, so that what they call bare branches in China, that you have an entire population. In fact, by the year 2020, it's going to be 40 million, same size as Canada, an entire population of men with no potential spouse, in China at least. These things, you know, they're not isolated to the womb. They will affect you. Dehumanization affects everyone.
Sometimes when I speak to my friends on the issue of abortion, especially in relation to some kind of a policy issue, I am told that it is just, don't be a single issue voter, right? Don't be a single issue voter. I'm like, okay, I can appreciate that. The problem is that this is not a single issue. This issue affects everything else, like your immigration policies and things like that. Just like you said, like, this is not just an isolated thing that we can neatly compartmentalize and push away. It impacts everything, everyone.
And this is why, ending on a positive note, that God loves you, God created you in His image, and our view of God is the most important view we have, because it, in fact, informs your view of yourself.
All right. Well, hopefully that last note there was redemptive. it was a lot of heavy stuff that we talked about. Thank you again for our listener who brought this to our attention. I think we'll wrap up here. Thank you for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more stuff to think about.